Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the Projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage. What type of periodical do you have there, Sage?
It's the new issue of Rumorg Magazine, Projectionist. I was visiting my local Barnes & Noble and happened to see it on the stands. It's a big celebration of Night of the Living Dead. Thought I might find some interesting facts that you and I didn't know. Something to share with the listeners.
Speaking of our latest radio broadcast, Victor, it appears that we have begun to record, judging by the light on the control panel being lit up. Once more, the Retroist acts as a maniacal puppeteer, forcing us to dance to an unheard tune.
My friend, as Ross keeps telling you on your own show, the Retroist is not spying on anyone in the vault.
Perhaps. But at the very least, as the dear listeners have proven, my sinister tales of terror has proven to be far more popular than this radio program.
Well, it does help that your podcast is on a near-weekly basis, man. With that, however, welcome back, friends, to the Saturday Frights podcast. It's been a couple of months since our last episode, the special on George A. Romero, so we thought it might be nice to go ahead and tackle 1968's masterpiece, Night of the Living Dead.
Yes, unlike the usual films you choose, Victor, this is most certainly a film that lives up to being labeled a masterwork.
Most definitely, Projectionist. One that has recently not only received a stunningly beautiful 4K transfer for a Criterion Collection release on DVD and Blu-ray, but just this week, I learned that Fathom Events is going to screen that very version on October 24th and 25th at selected theaters, which marks a couple of weeks after Night of the Living Dead's 50th anniversary.
50 years? Where does the time go?
Time passes you by quickly, I guess, when you shun society and hole up under the haunted drive-in, right?
What?
Nothing. For what it's worth, listeners, that restoration was thanks to both the Museum of Modern Art as well as the George Lucas Family Foundation. It just so happens that I'll be on vacation at the time of the Fathom event screening. You can be sure I'll be in attendance.
Another vacation, Sage? How many does the Retroist grant you in a year?
What are you talking about, Projectionist? This will be the first vacation I've had since last year, and that was only for 2 days.
Just last week, intern Rockford J explained why you weren't answering my summons. He said you were out of the vault for the week.
That was because I was having dental surgery, Projectionist. I told you that before I left for the procedure.
Oh, well, I am sorry to say they weren't able to do a thing about your hideous visage.
Moving on. Friends, I doubt any of you that are kind enough to listen to our podcast hasn't had the pleasure of seeing George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead. Heck, I doubt we'll be able to even shed any information on this podcast that you do not already know yourself. But we thought it would still be nice to talk about our memories of seeing the film for the first time.
I already shared that with the dear listeners on the George A. Romero radio broadcast.
I'm sure you have a little more to talk about in regards to showing it at the Haunted Drive-In, my friend.
We shall see, I suppose.
I guess the best way to start, listeners, is by talking about the first time I saw Night of the Living Dead. I gave a little explanation of it on the George A. Romero podcast, of course. But, unlike with Night's sequels, Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead, I didn't first watch it on VHS, but on television. All thanks to MTV and Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. On a 1984 Halloween special, for 6 hours, the hostess with the mostess held sway over horror fans on Halloween night itself, in a special entitled Elvira's MTV Halloween Party.
Yummy, yum, yum. Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Halloween. For those of you who don't know me, no, this ain't a commercial for American Express. For those of you who don't know me, I'm usually hosting some stupid horror movie, but my friends here at MTV asked me to schlep on in here tonight on account of it's like Halloween. Well, no, as a matter of fact, it isn't like Halloween. It is Halloween. Well, anyway, they figured that if anybody knew about ghosts and goblins and things that go bump in the night, it had to be me. Why, heck, it usually is me. And I simply can't think of a better way to spend Halloween than right here with me on MTV.
Listeners, Elvira introduced appropriately holiday-themed music videos, like Rockwell's Somebody's Watching Me, Ghostbusters by Ray Parker Jr., etc. But in the middle of the six-hour special, they also aired Night of the Living Dead, which just so happened to include a special introduction by George A. Romero. As I mentioned in the last episode, thanks to a neighborhood kid at the bus stop, I knew the gist of Dawn of the Dead before even learning of Night of the Living Dead. Yes, I was that kind of kid that had to read or watch things in order. So, I had to wait until Night of the Living Dead before renting Dawn.
Victor, how old were you when you watched this television event?
Let's see, I would have been 12.
And your family had no qualms with you watching a film about the dead returning to life to feast upon the living?
Not really. Like I've mentioned before, besides certain things, like my father wouldn't have let me watch The Last House on the Left or Cannibal Holocaust, anything like that. But movies he really enjoyed, or in the case of new films, if he wanted to see it, he would have to bring me along as well. Now, friends, I might be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure we had just recently had MTV added to the line of basic channels. I recall knowing about Elvira's MTV Halloween Party thanks to some fellow kids talking about it on the school bus. However, as I've mentioned before, many times it was my father or grandparents that decided what we would be watching in the evening. So, after I returned home from trick-or-treating, bag heavy with sugary treats, and hopped up on the heady thrill of running up and down my grandparents' neighborhood in costume.
What sort of costume did you wear that Halloween?
Oh, I'm pretty positive it was the Collegeville E.T. the Extraterrestrial Halloween costume. I think I have some photos of it laying around my house. I'll see if I can't dig it up and include it in the post on the Retroist for this episode. Anyway, I got home feeling great, as most kids do when finishing trick-or-treating, and assumed I would get to watch Night of the Living Dead.
I sense things did not go according to plan,
That is correct, my friend. My father and grandparents were busy watching something on television. I recall it being a film that my father had rented after work. Obviously, they didn't want to stop their movie in the middle of it. So, I had to resort to using the spare black and white 10-inch television. It was a little portable TV, and what I would do is, by using a splitter, I would roll out a stretch of cable to hook into the back of the TV, generally using it in my grandparents' bedroom, so noise wouldn't be an issue. This is how I'd play video games for the most part as well, when I couldn't use the main TV.
With Night of the Living Dead being black and white, I doubt watching it on that television set hurt the viewing experience, Sage.
Not in this case, projectionist. In fact, leaning in a little to get a better view of the TV screen kind of made it more intense. And listeners, turning off the lights in the bedroom just moments after the film had begun, with Barbara and her brother Johnny driving up to pay their respects to their kin at the cemetery, I was hooked. Like, everything was in tunnel vision almost. That is how engrossed I was watching this movie. By the time the principal characters have been introduced and the siege of the farmhouse has begun, there was something else besides a total focus creeping in. I was getting scared.
Oh, really?
Absolutely, my friend. It just goes to show how much craftsmanship George A. Romero and his colleagues and friends put into the film. It's a slow burn, but it gets more and more tense as the film progresses. So much so that around halfway through the movie, I actually brought the black and white TV out during a commercial break, setting it up in the hallway so I could find a little comfort with my family behind me in the living room.
I'm quite surprised you were scared by the film, Victor. You talk about how you grew up as a monster kid, and this 1968 picture gave you the willies?
Hey now, I was 12 years old, and there was some major stuff going down on that movie. I mean, once Tom and Judy buy it, you know, this is a whole different type of horror film. Truly, no character is safe. For what it's worth, that is something that Roger Ebert touched on in his original 1969 review of the film.
How so?
Well, I recall you mentioned the film was released unrated. Is that correct?
Indeed.
I guess since it was unrated, this theater in Chicago that Roger Ebert saw the film, it was a Saturday matinee, 40 cents for a ticket at that. The theater didn't feel the need to warn the children who were being dropped off by their parents.
Oh my.
In Ebert's review, which I will be sure to link to on the post for this podcast on the RetroWest site, he had this to say about what he witnessed while watching the film. I'm including it as it touches on how I felt after seeing Night of the Living Dead. Quote, the kids in the audience were stunned. There was almost complete silence. The movie had stopped being delightfully scary about halfway through and had become unexpectedly terrifying. There was a little girl across the aisle from me, maybe 9 years old, who was sitting very still in her seat and crying. I don't think the younger kids really knew what hit them. They were used to going to movies, sure, and they'd seen some horror movies before, sure, but this was something else. This was ghouls eating people up, and you could actually see what they were eating. This was little girls killing their mothers. This was being set on fire. Worst of all, even the hero got killed. It's hard to remember what sort of effect this movie might have had on you when you were 6 or 7. But try to remember. At that age, kids take the events on the screen seriously, and they identify fiercely with the hero. When the hero is killed, that's not an unhappy ending, but a tragic one. Nobody got out alive. It's just over. That's all. End quote. Friends, that pretty much sums it up. I had never seen a film before like Night of the Living Dead. It was my first taste of a nihilistic ending. I had the same kind of emotional response when first watching Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid on video a couple years later. Now, I didn't break down crying or anything like that when Ben dies, but on the way home, I worked through my feelings by talking to my father, basically telling him about the entire movie. Shockingly, he hadn't seen it before either, and I kind of wonder if he wasn't questioning the decision to let me watch it by the time we got home. Here's the thing, though. After I finished telling him all about it, I realized just how much I loved it. This wasn't a jump scare kind of horror. This was something I had never experienced before. Although, saying that, it was a little akin to how I felt watching 1980's The Changeling.
That is most certainly a masterpiece of terror as well, dear listeners.
Absolutely, projectionist, and we need to tackle it for the podcast one of these days. Now, I had seen plenty of slasher films by this point. Friday the 13th, My Bloody Valentine, Prom Night, Terror Train. Heck, I think it was like 2 weeks later that A Nightmare on Elm Street hit theaters. Although, I didn't catch that until on VHS the next year. Anyway, two things happened after watching Night of the Living Dead. While I may not have been able to communicate it properly, I was a fan of the zombie genre.
They aren't identified as zombies in this film, Victor, but ghouls or flesh eaters.
Thank you, projectionist. I was aware of that fact. Anyway,
I didn't want the dear listeners to miss out on that important fact.
Thank you. Again, afterwards, I would try to track down any books, films, comics. It didn't matter as long as it had something to do with the living dead. Zombie, or ghouls, as my co-host pointed out, was the bee's knees to me. In addition, I learned that I loved the Siege film. Rio Bravo, Assault on Precinct 13, Dawn of the Dead, of course, Aliens, The Mist, you get the idea. There is something so primal in the story of strangers or loved ones having to hole up and withstand an attack, as forces from outside attempt to get within what should be thought of as a place of safety or normality.
So, I'm going to assume you pestered your poor father into reading a copy of 1978's Dawn of the Dead.
I tried, projectionist, but I think my father decided, and rightfully so, to wait until I was a little older. Like, by a year. Night of the Living Dead is, yet again, truly a masterpiece. But somehow, Romero and friends managed to lift the bar even higher with the 1978 sequel.
Agreed. Were you aware, Sage, that the co-creator of Night of the Living Dead, John Russo, had another genre in mind when George A. Romero and Rudy Ritchie began to bandy about ideas for their first film?
I didn't know that, projectionist. Do you know what genre it was?
Of course. It was science fiction. In addition, it was to have comedic elements. The story concerned aliens visiting Earth and meeting up with teenagers, having an adventure of sorts. Supposedly, when the Pittsburgh-based filmmakers felt that making a science fiction film wouldn't be so easy with their limited budget, it was Russo who came up with the idea about a young boy who finds a cemetery with rotting corpses underneath glass. That naturally would rise up and assault the living. George A. Romero obviously felt they had something with the dead returning to life and feasting on the living. And that is how Night of the Living Dead's first screenplay started.
Huh, I hadn't heard that before. I suppose we should go ahead and do a brief synopsis for the film, projectionist.
Oh, here we go, dear listeners. This would be the time you need to get up and walk away from all your radios to make yourself some dinner.
Thanks, projectionist. Your unwavering support is always so refreshing. Night of the Living Dead opens, like I mentioned earlier, with Johnny and Barbara driving up from the city to place a remembrance on the grave of their loved one, for their mother, who is too old to make the trip herself. Johnny is played by Russell Striner, with Judith O'Day portraying Barbara, while at the cemetery, Barb is attacked by what we will later learn is a ghoul. Johnny, in trying to defend his sister, wrestles with this attacker, loses his balance, and is killed when his head strikes a gravestone as they fall. Barbara attempts to flee, seeking shelter briefly within the car, before the attacker picks up a stone and shatters the window to reach her. Johnny apparently had the keys. But after putting the car in neutral and accidentally releasing the emergency brake, the car rolls downhill, smashing into a tree. But it does provide a little distance between Barbara and the ghoul. The young woman, groggily, escapes on foot, with the attacker close behind. Finding a farmhouse, seemingly deserted, she stumbles upon the grisly scene of a half-devoured corpse and attempts to flee, where she encounters Ben, played by the late and great Dwayne Jones, who absolutely steals the entire film. It's good that he's arrived, as more and more of the recently dead are starting to head towards the farmhouse. This is all too much for Barb to take. And can you blame her? She practically goes comatose as Ben attempts to get some answers from her. It turns out, though, that Ben and Barb are not alone. They don't realize that underneath their feet in the basement are Harry and Helen Cooper, played by Carl Hardman and Marilyn Eastman. With them is their daughter, Karen, who we find out is very sick. We don't learn until later that she was bitten by one of the ghouls when the trio were fleeing from their car that had been overturned by a mob of the monsters. Also in the basement with Harry and Helen are a young couple, Tom and Judy, played by Keith Wayne and Judith Ridley. Young Karen, by the way, is played by Kyra Scone. Romero does an exceptional job of showing how the differing personalities, these strangers trapped together, don't exactly all come together for the common good. Harry, although it's not explicitly stated, appears to me to be a bit of a racist in the way he talks to Ben. Friends, take a moment and think when this film was first released. How refreshing it must have been to see Ben, a young black man, not only standing up to the bully-like nature of Harry, but being the hero of the film itself.
Although, dear listeners, I think George A. Romero was wise in showing by the end of the film that Ben's reluctance to not go down into the cellar was folly.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you, projectionist. Ben is able to organize these survivors. Well, those that feel staying in the basement isn't the best decision in this case, at least as far as they know. Ben is able to get them to start boarding up the windows and doors as more and more of the living dead show up outside the farmhouse. Throughout the film, thanks to a radio and eventually a TV the group finds, we learn bits and pieces of what is going on outside of the farmhouse, giving us a bigger picture of the event. First reports are that for some unknown reason, mass attacks, murders, are happening all along the East Coast. And, a little at a time, it's confirmed that the ghouls are in fact the recently risen dead.
If reports, incredible as they seem, are not the results of mass hysteria. First eyewitness accounts of this grisly development came from people who were understandably frightened and almost incoherent. Officials and newsmen at first discounted those eyewitness descriptions as being beyond belief. However, the reports persisted. Medical examinations of some of the victims bore out the fact that they had been partially devoured. I think we have some late word that's just arriving, and I'll interrupt to bring this to you. This is the latest disclosure in a report from National Civil Defense Headquarters in Washington. It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder. A widespread investigation of reports from funeral homes, morgues, and hospitals has concluded that the unburied dead are coming back to life and seeking human victims. It's hard for us here to believe what we're reporting to you, but it does seem to be a fact.
By the time the survivors decide to make a break for it, to attempt to refuel Ben's truck and get to safety, the film is running on high. Ben, Tom, and Judy, who follows her boyfriend into the truck, manage to get to the gas pumps, which we first saw at the beginning of the movie when Barbara was running up to the farmhouse. Which, gas pumps at a farmhouse make sense, as they would use them to refuel tractors and such. But, unfortunately, a torch, which the living dead, akin to Frankenstein's monster, show a fear of, has been dropped into the truck bed. Which is bad timing for Tom, who manages to splash the truck with gasoline. Tom and Judy drive off without Ben, attempting to put the flames out, but end up blowing up. Ben has only a moment to look on in horror as the living dead begin to feast on the charred remains of the young couple. Making his way back to the farmhouse, Ben finds he's been locked out by Harry Cooper. The young man is able to get back inside and rightfully beats Harry for almost getting him killed. This moment is bad timing for the electricity to finally be knocked out. The living dead begin to break through the barricades of the farmhouse, with Harry showing his true colors and rushing into the basement after a tussle over a rifle results in Ben shooting Harry, wounding the coward. The man, though, finds his little girl waiting for him downstairs. She apparently passed away and has risen as one of the living dead. Upstairs, things aren't going well at all. After being grabbed by the ghouls, Helen decides to head downstairs herself and finds her daughter feasting on her late husband. The poor woman doesn't fare any better, however, as Helen in shock watches as Karen picks up a trowel and then she stabs her mother to death with it. Upstairs, Barbara gets a horrible shock as she notices Johnny attempting to force his way into the farmhouse. She is grabbed and pulled out, and to me, it looks like her brother begins to feast on her. This leaves our hero Ben, realizing that he won't be able to stop the living dead from getting into the farmhouse by himself, deciding to hightail it to the cellar, after having to shoot Karen, who has emerged from the basement. As he barricades the cellar door, he discovers the fate of both Harry and Helen Cooper, shooting them as well. In the morning, a posse of men who are traveling the countryside and dispatching the living dead come across the farmhouse. Hearing the gunshots, Ben approaches the window, cautiously, where he is shot in the head by the posse.
Yes, I recall being able to hear a pin drop, dear listeners, when the patrons at the Starlight Starbright Family Fun Drive-In first saw Night of the Living Dead. No one dared utter a single word as the credits rolled, and we see grainy photographs of the posse rounding up the dead and throwing them on a giant bonfire.
I can only imagine, Projectionist. For what it's worth, I showed the movie to the Arcadian kids. Listeners, for those of you who haven't heard the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast, that is the nickname we gave to the regulars who became our friends at the arcade I work at. Most of them had seen the 1990 remake, directed by Tom Savini, which has a similar ending. And they were absolutely silent, too, until the last credit had appeared. It's still incredibly powerful, even today. Funny enough, it appears that Romero and his fellow filmmakers had discussed filming an alternate ending, one in which Ben actually survived.
Really?
Yeah, I found this in Joe Kane's Night of the Living Dead. It was Dwayne Jones who insisted that Ben die, the actor saying, quote, "I convinced George that the black community would rather see me dead than saved, after all that had gone on, in a corny and symbolically confusing way," end quote. Continuing further, he said, quote, "The heroes never die in American movies. The jolt of that and the double jolt of the hero being black seem like a double-barreled whammy," end quote.
As I understand it, Victor, the character of Ben wasn't originally intended to be black, yes?
Absolutely. Romero had gone on record numerous times saying that he merely cast the best actor who gave the best audition. And, like I've already mentioned, Jones was a powerhouse, and every scene he is in, you understand why he would feel he has to take charge of the situation. Especially at the beginning, when Barbara is out of it. Also in Joe Kane's book, which, if you are a fan of Night of the Living Dead, you should totally pick up, Carl Hardman mentions that Dwayne himself rewrote his dialogue for the film. Originally, the character of Ben was supposed to be a trucker, an uneducated trucker at that. Jones, obviously an educated man, altered the lines to suit his character better. In that book, you can read some of the original script, which apparently only Marilyn Eastman was wise enough to keep hold of. The dialogue as it was, of course, wasn't bad. It's just that Jones certainly improved it, which is understandable as he was a BA graduate from the University of Pittsburgh and had the opportunity to study abroad in Paris and even Norway. It appears that while the film did phenomenally well, Jones attempted to distance himself from it. Although his career continued in a few more films and through stage work, where Jones worked not just as an actor but director, he never dissed the film. He sadly passed away in 1988 at the far too young age of 51.
As I shared in the George A. Romero broadcast, I ended up having repeat business from Night of the Living Dead, especially in those first few weeks as word of mouth spread amongst the citizens of Haddonfield. On Saturdays, I was even forced to show a midnight showing of the film. This was, of course, for college students and the like.
I believe Night of the Living Dead was made for $114,000. Now, granted, even in 1968, that wasn't much, but it would end up netting $30 million in total. To say it was a success is an understatement. But there was a little problem. Do you know what the original title of the film was going to be, Projectionist?
Night of the Flesh Eaters.
You are correct. The company that was distributing the film found out there was already a 1964 film by that name, and it was changed to Night of the Living Dead. But they forgot to put the copyrights on these prints, which opened it up to pretty much anyone being able to make a copy of it, as it was public domain. Not to mention that it was the distributors who reaped the lion's share of the profits, thanks to a bad deal that Romero made.
The copyright laws were changed in 1989, dear listeners, which is one of the reasons the 1990s remake of Night of the Living Dead can't be.
That's right, Projectionist. It was an attempt by Romero and his fellow investors to shore up the claim to the first film, which, if I remember correctly, they took to the courts in an attempt to get revenue from unlawful duplications. I don't believe they ever succeeded, however. I did find out something I found rather interesting, though, and that is when Barbara is kneeling next to a tombstone while Johnny is being attacked. That took place in Evans City Cemetery. A real cemetery, of course. And the gravestone happens to belong to one Nicholas Kramer, who was born in 1842 and passed on in 1917.
How interesting. Did you know that the farmhouse where Romero shot the film, which has long since been demolished, did not include a basement?
Okay, but we see them open the door and go down the stairs, Projectionist.
Of sorts. In actuality, it led to something like a fruit cellar. The basement scenes within Night of the Living Dead were filmed in the cellar of where the film was edited in Pittsburgh.
I'm afraid I didn't know that, Projectionist. I'm not sure I can add much more, beyond just how very groundbreaking this film was, friends. The filmmakers helped to usher in an entirely new horror genre. While it is true, the movie itself owes a big tip of the hat to Richard Matheson, with his equally groundbreaking 1954 novel, I Am Legend. Although with Night of the Living Dead, you had ghouls instead of vampires.
Wasn't it Dawn of the Dead when Romero finally started to refer to them as zombies?
Yep, in Night of the Living Dead, there is a possible reason given for the dead rising, and that is a space probe being destroyed above the Earth. It might be cosmic radiation that has brought the dead to life.
Do you accept that idea, Sage?
Well, for myself, I love that in the franchise, no one really knows why. Although, personally, I subscribe to what the helicopter pilot John says in 1985's Day of the Dead. Friends, I think that about wraps it up for this particular podcast. In closing, however, I feel we need to point out that without George A. Romero and his fellow filmmakers, without Night of the Living Dead in 1968, we wouldn't have the likes of some excellent zombie entertainment. 1979's Zombie by Lucio Fulci, Return of the Living Dead, Dead Heat, 28 Days Later, Shaun of the Dead. Nor would we have the likes of the original Resident Evil games, or even Robert Kirkman's insanely popular The Walking Dead. Not to mention hundreds of books and comic series. While I think it's safe to say that Dawn of the Dead is an even better film than Night of the Living Dead, we horror fans owe a great deal of gratitude to that original 1968 picture, as well as to Romero and his cast. Now, Projectionist, do you want to tell the listeners about the surprise you have for next month's show? The Halloween episode?
Why, certainly, Victor. Dear listeners, We have once again invited our friends from the Retroous Vault and beyond to attend the Haunted Drive-In to share their memories and feelings on John Carpenter's Halloween.
Halloween. I think he'll come back. Halloween, the night he came home. Rated R.
Friends, thank you again for joining us for the Saturday Frights podcast. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. If you have musical needs, you can contact him at peachy@retroist.com. My co-host, The Projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. He generally shares old movie posters and newspaper advertisements throughout the week. It's always neat to see what vintage thing he can dig up to share. Our newest intern is Rockford J. You can find him every day sharing his own love of retro horror on the Saturday Frights Facebook page. As for myself, you can still find me posting a couple times a day on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee page too. I even managed to find time to write on the Retroist Clubhouse on Facebook now and again. If you'd like to contact me with suggestions for future episodes, you can reach me at vicsage@retroist.com. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself, not just for hosting the podcast, but for creating a place where we can all share in our love of things retro. So when you need your retro fix, and we all do, make sure to visit the Retroist. Until next time, the vault is sealed.
This has been a Retroist production. Sleep well, and goodbye.